Good morning, everyone. It's amazing to be in this wonderful building and this beautiful Zendo. I want to thank Sosan and Rob for being splendid hosts, for sending their black cat with a white nose to sleep with me last night, who woke me up for a little early morning lovemaking and then bit me. That's the way life is, right? Anyway, I'm really pleased to be here to see my friends from Hokioji. A couple of them have showed up. We had a wonderful, I wasn't actually leading, I was a co-leader of the Sesshin, which is half the responsibility and twice the confusion. Where you can tell that guests are from another sangha is just watch them closely. During the chants, you'll see them start to say the wrong words and then correct themselves, because every chant is just a little bit different. So my friend Marilyn came and insisted that before I give my talk, I tell you just a little bit about myself. When Rob was introducing me, I thought, boy, it sounds really cheesy, doesn't it, to say an actor has written two memoirs. They're not exactly memoirs. One is a study of the 1960s, the radical anarchist left, and the other is about a search for wisdom in the spiritual path. But a couple things I can tell you about myself that will account for the peculiar flavor of my Dharma talks. I grew up in a secular Jewish family, a lot of communists, socialists, union organizers, civil rights people. People who tried to practice compassion through politics. That was their understanding. And that's been an abiding training of mine. Through circumstances that are written out in my book, but I'll just tell you that I was raised by a black family and community for 12 years and have about 100 people that I consider family in Henderson, North Carolina. And that colored my view on what being white meant and what white culture meant, and has been an abiding concern of mine to help myself root out the vestiges of white privilege and to expose it in my culture to other people. Those are the two secular strains other than Zen practice which have kind of organized my life. And sometimes when I give Dharma talks, they can be a little more political than some people expect. I stumbled that way a little bit at Hokioji. I've refined it. Everything will be decorous and nice today. So what I'd like to talk about today, sorry I have to bring this up, but it's a different typeface, is what we can do when there's nothing we can do. When we're faced with circumstances that are too obdurate, too large, too complex, we just don't know what to do. What do we do? So from 1956 to 1958, my friend Gary Snyder was living in Japan. He was studying Zen Buddhism at a Rinzai monastery. And this was in kind of post-construction Tokyo, which had been decimated during the war. And there was, to Americans, unspeakable poverty and destruction. And Gary wrote a poem called This Tokyo that I'd like to read parts of. I won't read the whole thing. This Tokyo. Peace, war, religion, revolution will not help. This horror seeds in the agile thumb and the greedy little brain that learned to snatch bananas with a stick. The millions of us, worthless to each other, or the world, or selves, the sufferers of the real or of the mind, the world is but a dream, or human life, a nightmare grafted on solidity of planet, mental, shudder of the sun, praise evil sub-mind freedom of Desad, or highest Dantean radiance of the God, or endless light, or love or simple tinsel angel in the candy heaven of the poor. Mental divinity, all. Plato, Aquinas, Buddha, Dionysus of the cross, all pains, all pleasures, hells, or what in sense or flesh and thought tend to this. This gaudy apartment of the rich, the comfort of the U.S. for its own, the shivering pair of girls who diked each other for a show, 1,000 yen before us men in an icy room to buy a meal for their relatives. This scramble spawn of wire, dirt, rails, tin board blocks, babies, students, crooked old men. We live on the meeting of the sun and earth, and all our lives have led to this city, which is soon the world, this hopelessness where love of man or hate of man could matter none. Love if you will, or contemplate, or write, or teach, but know in your human marrow, you who read, that all you tread is earthquake rot and matter mental. Trembling, freedom is a void. Peace, war, religion, revolution will not help. So this poem is about as clear as an expression of nothing you can do as I could imagine. I read it in 1960. I was a freshman in college. It was in a great book called New American Poetry, 1945 to 1960, that my friends and I passed around like a Bible, and we absorbed it. And this poem struck me then. I never forgot it. I was in my Hamlet phase, customary clothes of inky black, black turtleneck, black jeans, camel cigarettes, writing deathless poems in a notebook. It was the perfect anarchic, depressed poem for a college freshman. I reread this poem in 1996, and I was 45 by then. I'd been practicing Zen for over 20 years. And Gary had by then become a close friend and a mentor. And by 1996, my view of the world was not nearly as miserable and dark and monolithic as I had assumed that poem to be. 30 years in love with and committed to a woman who interests me immensely. Our talks, our cooking together, our honesty with each other have lightened my world a lot, and I've begun to see some chinks of light in the poem itself, some space to move around in. When he was young, Gary was a champion mountain climber, a free climber, who didn't use ropes or safety devices. And if you get a chance, there's a film out now called Solo, about a young man who climbed the 3,000-foot half dome in Yosemite without ropes, a face that two master climbers died from day before yesterday, climbing it with ropes. Impossible to conceive the tininess of the handholds that he'd mapped out on the face, where he could just get the tips of a finger or a toe to hold him. Well, there are handholds like that in that poem. Gary Snags turns the poem, opens the poem on the tiniest handhold of the word tends. And he uses it twice, one in the sense of leaning toward, or intending toward, and the other in the sense of listen. Thought tend to this. So in the first case, he tells us that thought has a bias in a particular direction. It's pretty negative, pretty grim. He witnessed it under construction in Tokyo. Exploited women, ruins, people starving, people doing whatever they had to do. It was like a Dantean vision of hell. Tokyo was rising like a mushroom out of the city, and it was replicating the America that he and the Bush poets had been, the beat poets. Where is my head? He and the beat poets had been critiquing and trying to get away from. And here he saw it rising in this land of Zen practice that he'd come to do. But a tendency is not a certainty. And so, Gary, things can look pretty bad, but the hope in the poem resides in the space that tend allows us. So, you know, greed, hate, and delusion is the tendency with which human beings are born. It's not certain that we have behaved that way. Buddha showed us the possibility that we certainly don't. But we can't avoid the fact that left to our own devices, human beings can be pretty wicked. We can really make a mess out of things. So Gary states that case very, very, very heavily, but he puts this little crack in it. And he gives it to us as a handhold. And in both the mountain climber's reality and in our Buddhist reality, the tiny little handhold we can grab is mindfulness. Mindfulness is what allows us to keep an eye on our impulses, on our thoughts, on our sensations, and decide what speech gets out past our teeth, what impulse gets out past our training. And that's where we get to reverse and make a countervailing force against the tendency of greed, hate, and delusion to take us down into entropy. If I try to take in the entire cliff face of Half Dome, I'd say my country's in a slow motion car wreck. It's painful to watch. My lovely world is being laid to waste. The treasures in it are being ignored, ground up and turned into money. It's painful. And I know it's painful to all the people here. We wouldn't be sitting on our cushions if we all felt that we lived in some paradisical splendor. So we all have this, and yet we're all single human beings, and what can we do? We see all of it all the time, and we have 24 hours, we have family, we have commitment, and yet still, and I'm always moved when I see it, we show up. Everybody showed up to sit and to work on themselves. It's just, I can't put into words how good it makes me feel. So Gary didn't want to see this. He's like me. I don't want to see this. I can't help the fact that my political training makes me read the newspapers every morning and dig up every nugget of misery to nurse my anger and my outrage at the ignorance that's turning my beloved world into horseshit. I don't want to see it, but it's here. Gary came back. He moved up into the mountains. He was kind of the linchpin of a rural community. They built a zendo, and they made Buddhism their kind of folk religion. So I'm older now than Gary was when he wrote that poem. And my feeling is, and sort of my forgiveness for its unified misery, is that that poem was the flip side of what Gary wanted from Buddhism and why he went to study. That was the shadow, that if I don't get out of this, I'm consigned, I'm condemned to this world. A friend and I at Hokyoji were discussing the world last night, and she asked me rhetorically, was there ever a time when it was different? I had to say no. I mean, as far back as we can read in history, the Gilgamesh epics, the Old Testament, Plato, Aristotle, Xenophon, Catullus, they're killing each other, they're massacres, there are hookers, there are horrors, what Zorba the Greek calls the full catastrophe. That's human life. It's all there. We're always attached to it. There's no place outside of it for us to stand. No pure place. We get this. This is sort of a difficulty with politics sometimes. We assume that maybe if we just stay on the right side, if we hate the right people, if we do the right things, we can stand outside of the complexity of all of it in some pure little blissful nirvana. Gary called that kind of thinking blissful sexless nirvana. has no funk, has no rub, has no, it's just a mental pet. We can't. As a boy, that was a problem for me. My people had strong analytical arguments. There were two sides. There was a side you had to be on and a side you couldn't be. You better be a union man. You better not be a scab. Simple. You better be for civil rights. You better not be anything else. You better be for compassion. You cut and dried. So here's the thing I think about Gary's poem today, is that the poem has been glimpsed through a small diameter lens. It's like he turned his focus down and he looked at Tokyo, and what he cut out was all of it. So when I, you know, freedom may be a void, he says, but you know, so is form. Once you get right down to it, it's all a void, and it's all these projections, the entire world of these projections generated by emptiness. So that's hardly a critique. What he left out was, where's Mount Fuji? Where's Hokusai's woodcuts of waves? Where are these wonderful, I love these Japanese names, of Japanese flowers, tubeki, camellias, kiku, chrysanthemums, ume, plum blossoms? They've all been excluded by the narrow focus of turning this lens down to look at one thing too closely. The singularity and forgetting the absolute, all of it. And it happens to all of it. We all do it. We have to do it to navigate through our daily lives. So every time we close down the focus too much, we cut out far more than we can include. It's kind of dumb, but it's actually, we do that. So the other night I offered a very political Dharma talk at Hokkyoji, and I was so focused, my lens was closed down so much on political betrayals of our elected class and our capital-owning class that I let a lot of anger and irritation and stuff leak out, and I was correctly called on it as a kind of practice flaw. Because what is our practice but modeling the behavior we would like to see in the world? Modeling the thoughts and sentiments and feelings that we know treat other people as equals. We're all generated by form. I mean, by formlessness. I may not like it, but I'm made of the same stuff as Donald Trump. I'm made of the same stuff as Pol Pot and Hitler and Martin Luther King Jr. and Mother Teresa. We are like radios. Human radios tuned in to the human frequency. It can all come through us. And if we don't know that, we have no idea how dangerous we can be. If we know that I'm not a good guy or a bad guy, I'm a human being, then we have a perfect reason to monitor our inner life and our behavior. The good guys dropped bombs on Baghdad in the middle of the night because we didn't like their leader. Killed women and children in their beds. That's the danger of being a good guy. So in my talk the other night, I did the same thing. I left out the great prairies. I left out the star-shot sky. I left out the hairy woodpecker with the bright scarlet slash on the back of its neck. I left out the indicators of all of it. I gave you the singularity, but not the all of it. And one of the things we do in our practice, one of the reasons we sink into formlessness every day, sink into the place beyond contradictions, beyond argument, is so that we can come back into the singularity refreshed and not too overly attached to it. Yeah, so this closing down is a problem. And we can have it in other areas. And one of the areas I'm just going to touch on really lightly, but I'm going to just leave you with a little challenge, to consider American public discourse as a closed down lens. Every plausible solution we could imagine in this room to almost any problem any one of us might have is excluded from consideration by a closed down tiny, tiny frame. And I'll tell you what the frame is. One side is the free market. One side is low taxes. One side says private sector, not government. And the other is the focus on individual rather than collective efforts. And because of that, nothing gets through that frame on our public media. So we forget about all of it in our public debate. We get the singularity, we get the small focus. It's the only super political thing I'll say today. That's a promise. So in our practice, we try hard to be precise and careful with one another. I loved going through Rohatsu Sesshin and watching people helping one another, passing the bowls at mealtime, extending someone's arm by taking their bowls. It's all intuitive, it's all felt. It all works very, very well. I take a guess that we all try pretty hard to be good people too. And as Hamlet said, there's the rub. So at mealtimes, we say of our food, we consider whether our virtue and practice are worthy of this offering. I don't know that my virtue and practice is worthy of it. I've never seen a Zen student who pushed himself away from lunch. Sometimes I wake up and I say, you know, does my virtue and practice deserve a car? The massive extraction of oil and steel and tin and copper and leather and rubber? I don't think so. Piped in free water when millions of people are walking 5 to 10 miles to get filthy, polluted water? Is my virtue and practice what brings this to me? No. What brings this to me is imperialism, capitalism, all the labors of many, many people, and we are living in privilege. Eldridge Cleaver once said that suffering in America is like being squeezed between pieces of silk. Sorry, it's a little typeface. So, as I said, we're connected with all of it, which means we're complicit with all of it, which means we are as attached to the evil of it as we're attached to the goodness of it. What do we do in that situation? Because I know that no one here would actively condone any of the evils that we've all come here to understand and to try to fix. This is why we sit with it. We sit with it to sink back into the undifferentiated, to take enough of a break to remember it's all connected, to re-nourish ourselves, to redouble ourselves so we don't burn out. So we go back into the fray rested with our compassion set, not making choosing sides too easily, moderating our anger, bringing humor into interchanges with people. This is the bath that we take day in and day out as we more and more loosely can accept all of it, because that's what we are. We're all of it. When we eat a bowl of rice, we're eating the entire world. None of us have been separate from sunlight. None of us have been separate from oxygen, from water, from pollinating insects, from microbes in the soil, all the way out to the Earth's place in the solar system. If Earth was closer to the sun, water would have boiled off. We wouldn't be here. If it was farther away, it would have frozen. We wouldn't be here. So this is it. This is it. We live in cities full of disappointed, hopeless, undereducated, underutilized people. Some people say, well, that's their problem. We gave them a shot. We sent them to school. They didn't take advantage of it. Screw them. Well, that's debatable, but what's not debatable is that their problems are ours. People are buying doorbells with cameras called Ring and setting them up all over their houses because they don't trust their neighbors. Other people are following the UPS trucks at Christmas and stealing the things off porches that they can't afford. When I was a heroin addict, I used to say crime is self-employment. Their problems are ours. We look over our shoulder at the auto teller because we're all in it together. You men once said, every day is a good day. And Suzuki Roshi once explained it. Today does not become yesterday. And Dogen Zenji fulfills that by saying today does not become tomorrow. Each day is its own past and future and has its own absolute value. I'm getting close to my time, so I have to skip ahead a little bit. I can say such things to this community because we're all practicing together. We're all practicing the Eightfold Path. I can say, sit, work on it, be with it. Really? What do I say to a man who's lost his job to globalism? Or what do I say to a single mother doing three jobs, menial jobs, to try to get her kids through school? What do I say to the relatives of Walter Scott or Philander Castile, young black men who were killed unarmed in routine traffic stops by the police? Just sit? It's not going to work. All I can try to do is be there, be with them, and in my practice, try to extend my practice day by day to include more and more people, to turn them, to open them. I can't say stop and smell the roses. So I have a metaphor that I share with people, and I'll share it with you to try to explain or clarify the distinctions between form and emptiness and also interdependence. So I ask you to imagine being on a hill or a cliff and looking at a choppy ocean that's full of little wavelets, not big rollers, just little choppy waves. So each of those waves comes up and we say, oh, that's a wave. And then it goes back into the ocean. And each of those waves can be a nameable thing in the universe. Could be a mountain range, could be a human being, could be a cheetah, could be a dolphin, could be a hummingbird. Could be a nebula, doesn't matter. They come up into form for a while, and they go back into the ocean. And what we forget and what they forget is that they've never for one instant not been part of the ocean. Not for one instant. A drop of water that breaks loose from a waterfall may have some anxiety, Suzuki Roshi says, at being separated from the river. But before it was a drop, it was the river. And at the bottom of its fall, it'll be the river again. And our lives are like that. And that's what makes us able, if we can keep our heads, to talk to anyone. We're all the same. We all run away from what we don't like. We run toward what we do like. Nobody's in a hurry to die. Everybody's grabbing something that'll be fun or taste good. In my reading and thinking about these things, I ran into the line, If I don't speak, I'm a coward. If I do speak, I lie. And what it means to me is that whenever you put something into words, you diminish all of it into a closed-down lens. You make it small, liberal, conservative, radical. What are they? Jewish, Catholic. They're just words. They're words, and we mistake the map for the territory. The word is not the thing. There's no hand in there. There's no such thing. There's no self in there. There's no little walnut with your name on it tucked under your liver. There's an awareness, which should make it pretty easy to work on bad habits and let go of things that we don't like. But if we think it's fixed at birth, if we think we've got a solid little homunculus up here or here, well, then we say, well, that's just the way I am, and game's over. Okay. So, if I don't speak, I'm a coward. If I do speak, I lie. Okay, so doing nothing, fearing engagement, or taking a stand, or not taking a stand, is cowardice. If we saw a man beating a woman in the street, we would have to do something, right? Maybe you think, maybe he has a gun. Okay, something. It has to be more than just taking a picture of it with your cell phone. That is changing the dialogue in police shootings, but it's not stopping them. But would you grab them? Would you sneak? Would you try to round up bystanders? Yeah, we got to do something. So The first two issues of the Black Panther Party newspaper were published in my house on stolen machines. Huey was a fan of the diggers. And consequently, the diggers, who were mostly white, we would stop at police when we saw police stopping black people. We would stop as witnesses, stay back far enough so we couldn't be accused of interfering, but as a witness. We can all be a witness. We can all be there. I once told a friend I'd rather make a sandwich for a hungry person than give a speech about hunger to 10,000 people, because making a sandwich is modelable. You can do it. Other people can see it and do it. So is witnessing. So is standing up, and so is speaking. So the question I started with this evening boils down to what to do when we can't make a sandwich, when a sister has cancer and is dying, when a child is forced to flee home due to trauma, when a mother is grieving because she's just found out a child wants a transgender operation. What do we do? There's no quick fix. Well, that's when our Zen training reassures us that we won't go crazy with grief. We can be there. We can sit there. So building our courage, our fortitude, and our patience, building the intimacy that makes us understand and trust one another so we can carry the Dharma forth and all its implications. I feel nourished when we open our frames. Sometimes we have to close them, but we have to always remember it's like inhaling and exhaling. We have to open, we have to close, just like our breathing. And each perspective gives us another possibility of action. So, thank you very much. I'm open to any questions in the 60 seconds I've left you.
3 minutes.
Oh, 3 minutes. Okay, thanks. Anyway, I'm sorry to go on like that. Yes.
So you mentioned, I would say guilt maybe, or feeling, do I deserve this car type of thing. So what is your path to deal with that?
So what I think is that asking the question itself is an act of virtue. And asking it aloud ceremonializes it. It doesn't necessarily buy you justification. But if you ask the question and you keep the question on the back burner like you would a problem in Sesshin, then it's always there in front of you. And you can decide not to get that extra something. You can decide, you can do what you can. I drive an electric car that's charged with solar cells. Does that make me more virtuous than you? No. But it's my solution to asking the question. And so when we say grace at lunch, we're not only saying it aloud, we're ceremonializing it, which means we make it physical. We take our thoughts and we make them physical.
We talked about when you can't do anything. You can always approach it with compassion.
With what?
With compassion.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, that is doing something. I was being a little dramatic. You can approach that problem with compassion, but sometimes we don't know what to do physically. That's what I was trying to get at, but that's a good call, man.
You mentioned that you were once a heroin addict. Could you speak to that a little more about addiction and your journey?
Yeah, it was really good until it wasn't. All addictions are kind of the same. There's some thought, some feeling, something that's too painful to bear. And before you let it rise to the surface, you begin a compulsive behavior. Maybe it's shopping, maybe it's sex, maybe it's gambling. My case, it was muffling my feelings with heroin. I had a junkyard dog in my psyche that I was afraid to face and afraid to tame. And eventually, just between 1965 and 1975, I lost 18 friends, close friends, people I knew, They either swallowed a bag of dope when they were arrested and it opened up and killed them in jail, or they overdosed. And I had to stop. I was a single father of a daughter, and I realized that if I overdosed, my daughter would go to the state. And it was unbearable. It was even worse than my own pain. So I called a doctor that I knew, and I got enough dope to get over the sickness. And then I put myself in psychotherapy, and I started to sit Zazen. And I worked with a therapist for a couple of years. He died. I started all over again, and by that time I'd been sitting for about 5 years, and so I've been sober since 1975. But you know, we've all got something that we don't want to face.
You're done.
What?
That's her signal that we're out of time.
Oh, okay. I thought you were bowing to the profundity of my answer. Yes, I'll recognize that one.